She's got some amendments.
I've got an amendment to the address.
We're going to start with Senate File 1117 with Senator Chaudhry. I understand he has people from out of town, and we want to get them home in case the weather gets any colder. Senator Chaudhry, 1117.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What we're doing with this Senate file is amending our second-degree burglary statute. The issue here stems from a couple of incidents. One, several of them in Washington County dealing with schools, and then the other in Hennepin County in Maple Grove last year, where the new Hindu temple, which is the largest Hindu temple in North America, was being constructed in Maple Grove, was broken into, and hundreds of thousands of dollars of damage was done. The current statute, burglary in the second degree, would not cover these types of institutions under that penalty. So what we're doing is amending the law to say that second-degree burglary in these establishments, government buildings, religious establishments, and school buildings, be included in that. And with me to testify is the Washington County Attorney.
Welcome to the committee. Please restate your name for the record. And let the record reflect we now have a quorum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Doug Johnson. I'm the Washington County Attorney. Last June, we had an incident at Oatman Junior High where students broke into the school, the art class, and caused approximately $200,000 worth of damage. Specific teacher, that is, the art teacher, was the target of this crime. Under the current status of the law, we could only charge that case as a burglary in the third degree. That really did not adequately reflect the serious nature of this offense. Burglary in the third degree covers the entry of any building with intent to commit theft or other felony or gross misdemeanor. Therefore, the Oatman Junior High burglary with $200,000 worth of damage is treated under the law the same as a burglary of a storage shed where a few garden tools are taken. There's a greater expectation of safety and respect given to schools, religious establishments, and government buildings. To group those buildings in with storage sheds, unattached garage, or any outbuildings does not reflect that greater expectation. This amendment is in line with how the burglary in the second degree statute previously recognized that burglaries of certain buildings are more serious. For example, in addition to burglary of a dwelling, burglary in the second degree also covers burglary of a bank and burglary of a pharmacy. In addition to the Oatman Junior High case, my office has prosecuted other cases where a school is the target of the crime. In 2006, three juveniles broke out 30 to 35 windows at Valley Crossing Elementary School in Woodbury. Same year, 2006, a storage shed, which contained track and field equipment, was burned down at Park High School in Cottage Grove. In 2002, three to four recent graduates of Tartan High School broke into the Carmack Theater, stole popcorn grease and popcorn, and then broke into Tartan High School and spread the grease and popcorn all over the halls.
Oh, yes, yes.
People feel violated when schools, religious buildings, and government buildings are invaded, just as they are when their homes are invaded. So I would ask this committee to support this legislation.
Any questions for the witnesses, members?
Well, Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Neville.
I can't remember the difference between third and fourth degree burglary. I thought that third degree burglary had to be a building that was capable of habitation.
No, that's burglary in the second degree, which is
okay.
One of the elements of burglary in the second degree would be a dwelling which is capable of having somebody live there.
And the distinction with
Senator Neville.
With first is that somebody is present.
That is correct, sir.
Mr. Johnson.
Is
present.
Okay.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you. Senator Chaudhry,
You make reference on the second page of that bill of a reference to making this new burglary status a crime, or if found guilty, a felony with an imprisonment up to 10 years. My question is on proportionality for a crime. Now, you make reference to breaking and entering into one of these buildings or establishments with the intent to commit a crime under, and then you make a statutory reference, 609-something. And I just wanted to know, if you could tell me, 10 years seems to be a very long time for a felony, and I just wanted to understand the proportionality of why you picked 10 years.
Senator Limmer, counsel has reminded me that the first statutory reference of 609.52 is to theft, and the second reference is to damage to property. Senator Chaudhry, the question on proportionality.
Mr. Johnson.
Let's
answer that.
Thank you. Keep in mind that under the sentencing guidelines, you're not going to be sentenced for 10 years. The proportionality comes more in the sentencing guidelines than it does in the maximum sentence. I believe that the burglary in the third degree, and I don't have the statute with me, I apologize, is 5 years. So this cranks it up. But I would be very, very surprised to see anybody go to prison for 10 years. And in fact, under the sentencing guidelines, it does not call for a prison sentence.
Follow-up, Senator Limmer?
Well, Madam Chair, it does make reference on this particular bill to 10 years imprisonment. On page 2, line 25, either directly or as an accomplice commits burglary in the second degree and may be sentenced to imprisonment for not more than 10 years, or to payment of a fine of not more than $20,000, or both.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, yes, it says for not more than 10 years, so we would like it to be more than 5 as it is currently.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I'm sure you see that that's not an increase from burglary in the second degree as it stands today. That is existing law. The issue is making this crime equal to or the equivalent of 1 through 4, I guess.
All right.
Whether it's a dwelling or a bank or a pharmacy. So
right.
I think there's proportionality in that. We're talking about a religious building, a church, synagogue, temple, mosque, whatever, and a school. So I guess I see the proportionality there.
Senator Chaudhry, do you have any other people who are here to testify on the bill?
Nope.
Is there any other people in the audience who would like to testify either for or against this bill? All right.
I move the bill, Madam Chair. Would that go to finance?
Well, members, I was just talking to my staff about that. It looks like it could go to the floor, but because we're doing a penalty increase, I'm concerned that we should send it to finance.
Get a fiscal note on this?
Well, if we send it to you, Madam Chair, then we'll be able to get a fiscal note on it. And if there are none, then we can. It's just that for penalty increases, we just don't know until we send it to finance and get it. Is that all right, Senator Chaudhry?
That's standard practice from my recollection, yeah.
All right. Senator Limmer has moved that Senate File 1117 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Sure.
Senator Chaudhry, while you're sitting there, how about Senate File 727?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This Senate file is looking to create a felony to commit theft of a computer that has identity information of an owner or others in its memory. And with me to testify on this is Dakota County Attorney Jim Backstrom, as well as the Minnesota Attorney General's office.
Mr. Backstrom, welcome to the committee. You've been busy.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. It's a pleasure to be back in front of you. I'm James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney, President-elect of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I'm here to testify in support of this change in the law for a very simple reason, and that is that identity theft is a significant and fast-growing crime in our state and across our country. And a large portion of identity theft cases involve computers. We believe that any time there's a computer involved in connection with attempting to steal someone's identity and identity information, that the value of the computer itself should not be the final say in terms of whether or not this is a felony-level offense. And that's all that this does. This bill merely says that if the value of the computer is over $250 but not more than $500, which in some cases computers are that have this information in it, but if it is used and has identity information contained within it when it is seized by law enforcement, then it would become a felony, as I understand the bill. And I think our AG's office and Attorney General Swanson, who is supporting and endorsing this bill, could speak a little more directly to the specifics than I could. But it is an important change in the law, and I think one that's needed in light of the rapidly growing identity theft problem that we have in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Backstrom. And is it Mr. Voigt?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The Attorney General is proposing this legislation because, as Mr. Backstrom indicated, identity theft is such a large and a growing problem. The theft statutes as they exist today tie the level of the offense to the value of the property stolen. And the problem with the current statute as it relates to the theft of a computer with identity information is that there is no easily quantifiable way to measure the value of the information. When a computer is stolen, can often be the information that is much more valuable to the thief than the computer itself. And that's why this bill makes it a felony to steal any computer with identity information. Computers rapidly lose market value, and it's not unusual at all for a laptop computer to fall below that $500 threshold, which would otherwise make the offense a felony.
Any questions for the author or the two testifiers? Mr. Voigt, I wondered if you can maybe answer a question for me. It's my understanding that current statute has a standalone section on computer theft law. Why is this not under that section, and why is it under the theft section of the law?
Madam Chair, there is a standalone computer theft statute, but that statute has the same problem with tying the value or tying the level of the offense to the value of the property stolen. Theoretically, this amendment could go into either statute, but the computer theft statute covers a much narrower range of theft conduct than the 609.52, the general theft statute. The computer theft statute would cover the classic scenario of a laptop stolen from a car, but it wouldn't cover a swindle scenario. It probably wouldn't cover an employee theft scenario. And there are all kinds of ways that a computer can come into possession of a would-be thief. So by putting into the general theft statute, you cover a much broader range of theft conduct.
Hmm. Well, in my linear mind, I would think that it would probably make more sense to put it in that section of the law. But we could change that section of the law. I think the future is sort of in that area, and maybe one of the things we ought to do is think about whether we want to take a look at that in the future, given how many we're now in the computer age. And so, all right. Any other questions for Senator Neville?
Madam Chair, do you know what the site is for that other computer statute? Do you know what the site is for that, or the Senate Council?
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, it's 609.89.
Okay. I'll take a separate look at that. But the second question I have, Madam Chair, is...
Senator Neville?
What is that statutory definition for identity information that we're incorporating by reference? Does somebody have the language of that? Just want to see how narrow
Mr.
or how broad it is.
Senator Neville, are you referring to page 2?
Page 221.
2.21. Line 2.21. Mr. Voigt, do you have that, or I could ask Mr. Backus? Senate Counsel has the information.
Senator, Madam Chair, the site for the identity information comes from the Identity Theft Statute 609.57, Subdivision 1.
Senator Neville, do you want more detail?
I know that. I'm wondering, what does it say?
Here, Senator Neville. Here, Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair and members, I can read it. Identity means any name, number, or data transmission that may be used alone or in conjunction with any other information to identify a specific individual or entity, including any of the following: a name, social security number, date of birth, government-issued driver's license or identification number, a government passport number or employer or taxpayer identification number, unique electronic identification numbers, addresses, account numbers, routing codes, or telecommunication identification information or access device.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
Just if a person's name was on the computer alone, that would be enough? I'm just wondering if that needs to be. I can see every other one that's on there.
What's
so special
Neville?
About a person's name if it's not tied to their social security number, passport?
Well, Senator Neville, in the identity theft, the definition is in a subparagraph 1, which is a name, social security number, date of birth, official government-issued driver's license or identification number, government passport number, or employee or tax identification number, all in one. But I guess if only one of them is on there, that would be an identity issue.
Yeah.
Senator Higgins.
I don't think that there's a computer alive that doesn't have some of that data on it. I mean, the minute you put any piece of data on it at all, you know, you start by putting in a piece of software, and pretty much the first thing you have to do is put your name on it.
Ask your question.
And so... I think this covers every computer. And I don't know if that's what you wanted, but I think that's what you have.
Senator Chaudhry, is in the intention to have more identity information than just a name? Mr. Voigt. Mr. Voigt.
Senator, Madam Chair, the computers that would not be covered by this bill would be a new computer in a store that has not been sold and a victim hasn't had an opportunity to put identifying information, perhaps even a used computer at a pawn shop where the information has been erased from it. We did not want to include those situations in this bill because it's really the information, it's the identifying information that this bill aims to get to. The definition can be tinkered with, but the reason that this definition was included is because it already exists in Minnesota law in the identity theft statute, and for identity theft crimes and crimes in this area, it's difficult to predict exactly what shape and form crimes will take as technology continues to progress.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
I can see the computers that haven't come out of the box yet, but you probably still have a problem even with computers that have had their hard drive erased. Because there are utilities that can recover an awful lot of that data. So you might not want to eliminate that batch if what you're trying to get rid of is identity data. Because as we found, there have been a lot of stories in the paper about computers that some company thought they had erased the hard drives. And some enterprising young soul has found all kinds of information that the company didn't want by knowing how to run a utility.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, would you...
Senator Chaudhry.
Would you like to see kind of a more identifying information in what we're proposing here? Driver's license, social security number, that type of thing. To just kind of elicit that here without referencing the statute. Is that something you prefer?
Senator Higgins.
Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, I think, well, I think pretty much every computer has some data on it, so I'm wondering whether it isn't, for purposes of narrowing down, it should be maybe more than just a name. Maybe your name and some other identifying feature.
Okay.
I don't know what other members think, but I...
Senator Higgins.
I sure think you've got every computer here.
Perhaps Mr. Backus could explain to us how the identity theft section works. Because this is a cross-reference to the definition of identity under the identity theft statute. But under that construction, it must be used in conjunction with something else.
Okay.
Because this is the list of definitions that came from there. I mean, for example, if something has a Jennifer Johnson on it, I mean, how many Jennifer Johnsons are there, right? But it must be in conjunction with something else. Mr. Backus, can you share with us how that's constructed?
Well, Madam Chair, the definition of identity in identity theft is the same one being cross-referenced here, so it would include any of those things, even a name alone. But in terms of the crime itself, you would have to transfer, possess, or use an identity that is not the person's own, which is one element, and then with the intent to commit, aid, or abet any unlawful activity, which is a defined term. So under the identity theft, you're clearly using the identity, and you're doing something more with it because you have the intent to aid, commit, or abet any other unlawful activity.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
That's only for that section of the statute, though. The way it's included in here, you don't have to have any intent to use the – you just got to take the computer, and if it has a name on it – I agree with Senator Higgins' point, I guess. It should be the name in conjunction with some of the other financial data or the other things that are there. Causes it to go up in seriousness.
And if we discuss it long enough, I think Mr. Bastrom will come up with the answer. But, Senator Neville, that was the direction that I was going in, is that in here it's not tied to something else.
Right.
And so it works in the identity theft section because it has other elements in it.
Oh, okay. Okay, I got you.
And is there a way to cure this by maybe putting some other elements in here? So that's what the author.
Madam Chair.
Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Backstrom is coming up with something to suggest.
Well, Madam Chair and senators, I think what you want to get to a clear understanding is just a person's name itself is not the type of information that we're concerned about. It's the name tied to the other identifying information that's set forth, with a great deal of specificity in 609.527. So I would just perhaps suggest for consideration that if we just added the language after the word information on line 2.21, where it says that has identity information, including the person's name and other identifying information as defined in and then reference that statute, which defines all of the other information, social security number, date of birth, driver's license numbers, other unique electronic identification numbers or addresses, telecommunication information or access codes and the like. That's what that statute sets forth, and I think if you tie the name to one of those other things, that's where we have a problem in terms of identity theft.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Chaudhry, this conversation reminds me of a bill you had 2 years ago, and you presented us with documentation that could be received by a $10 check and a request through internet just off a driver's license number, and you showed us all of the information you could get, not with name and driver license, but just driver license number. And you created quite an impressive file. I think it was even about me on that. And I still have as boring a life now as I did when you pulled up that report. But I think we have to be careful as we try to write this, putting in the word and. Maybe it would be or, because if it was a name plus an identifying number or an identifying account, then someone still could get information. And I think we have to be careful about that if we just had an account number. And I would imagine maybe even Social Security numbers might be able to reveal things if you just had a number and could extrapolate it out somewhere. And if we didn't have, if we had name and a number, then we may be missing the boat of what you really want. That's one point to concern ourselves with. Also on page 2, line 22, we make reference to the computer and its memory about the owner or any other person. And I'm wondering if about the owner is what you're really trying to get at. Were you really maybe looking for in its memory which would identify the owner rather than just an about the owner? Someone could pull up a computer and there might be a Google search reference that's in there about some person, but that isn't really what you're after. You're after identifying information. So I might suggest take out the word about the on line 22 and put in which would identify the owner. But we can talk about that. But I think that's what you wanted, wasn't it?
I mean, I think, Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry made a good point. I mean, I just typed in your name.
Oh, I see.
Got your driver's license mm-hmm. number.
Senator Shy.
But I would imagine it would cross-reference both ways if you had that.
Right. And it did. So, having the name in there can be pretty dangerous as well. And maybe that is descriptive of the extent of the problem that we have. Yeah, you can steal a computer, probably just boot it up, figure out whose name it is. Maybe there's some other stuff on there that you can piece together.
Post-it note with
no
the password.
Social Security number. You haven't gone that far yet. And create a driver's license with their address and their name. Maybe a checking account number. Maybe we want to think about whether removing just the name is a good idea, because you can create a fake identity with someone's name. So maybe along
Senate
the lines
Council,
of what you're suggesting is better.
Senate Council has some suggested language that might work for us. Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair, that it wasn't taken into account Senator Chaudhry's last comments, though, but if the members did want to essentially back out name information only from the identity information, you can consider on page 2, line 21, after the fourth comma, which is the last one, after paragraph D, insert, but not including a name alone, comma.
Madam Chair, we can try that, too. The prosecutors to the left and right of me indicate that in their practice, it's not just the name they're after. They would have to establish a whole range of identifying information to move forward with any prosecution. So, I mean, we can exclude the name, but just with the caveat that it is possible to create an identity just with someone's name.
Well, Senator Chaudhry, I believe that this language would say you need something else other than just the name.
That's fine.
That's okay. Mr. Voigt, is that all right?
Madam Chair, yes, to use the language suggested by Mr. Backus, I think, would accomplish that.
Senator Limmer moves that on line 2.21, after paragraph D, comma, insert, but not including a name alone.
comma.
Miss English teacher.
It's a curse. I'm sorry.
Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed say nay. All right. Senator Limmer.
Senator Chaudhry, the other reference I made was on line 22 concerning the words about, and to remove that and include which would identify the owner. What do you think of that suggestion?
Senator Chaudhry.
Madam Chair, that's fine. You want to make that change?
Senator Higgins, the English teacher.
Madam Chair, you talk about identity information that identifies the owner. It's a little on the redundant side for me. So I wouldn't do it.
I'll withdraw.
It's been withdrawn.
Madam Chair.
I'll make something
else. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I don't want to belabor this. I'm sorry, I listened to what Mr. Backus read from 609.527, but I don't remember hearing, were bank accounts or charge card listed in that?
They Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, well, let me just read it again, but it includes any name, number, or data transmission that may be used alone or in conjunction with any other information to identify a specific individual or entity, including any of the following.
Oh, including.
And then there's the three clauses. And
I'm sure that would answer because it says including, so it's could
very
be
good.
Those.
Thank All you. Right. Is there any other people here in the audience who would like to either testify either for or against Senate File 727? As amended. Any further discussions on Senate File 727 from the members?
Madam Chair, we as this moves forward, we can visit with Mr. Backus as well about that, the whole computer theft standalone statute, and if we can, if the committee is okay with kind of opening that can of worms to kind of update that statute with current events and current affairs, we can explore that as well.
So, Senator Chaudhry, if you do that in the Finance Committee, it'll have to come back here, just so that you know.
Okay.
So, all right. Senator Limmer moves that Senate File 727, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Have
members.
A good trip.
Thank you.
Where's he going?
Who's leaving?
A number of the people who are here came from far away just to observe the community.
If we took out the word identity,
Senator Chaudhry, are you still here?
About to during next week.
Especially
there it goes.
Well, this is what we'll do.
Someone just went to get him.
Senator Neville has a theft bill, and there might be some possible effect on Senator Chaudhry's bill. So what I should have done was I should have taken the Neville bill before that Chaudhry bill. But why don't we do this? If Senator Neville's bill does have some kind of impact on the Chaudhry bill, we'll talk to Senator Chaudhry, and we can discuss that, and then we'll talk to Senator Chaudhry to see if he can just take care of it in finance. And we might agree to not have it pulled back. But if it does have an impact, though.
I don't think it does. Do you think it does? Okay.
It might. Senator Chaudhry, it's my fault. Senator Neville has a theft bill that we're taking up tonight, and it might have some impact on your bill.
Okay.
Do you need to get some more, or can you hang out for a little bit while we do his bill?
Sure.
And then that way we can let you go. Is that okay?
Can you stay here?
Yeah. Can you stick around? All right. Thanks. Because that way we won't have to yank you back. Why don't we have Mr. Backus talk about it, Senator Chaudhry, while you're in the room. Senator Neville, go down to the table. We'll deal with you there. Right.
Madam Chair and members, it's kind of a minor impact, or almost it would be a conforming change, but under Senator Chaudhry's bill and under current law, if the computer was worth not more than $500, the penalty would be enhanced. One of the things that Senator Neville proposes to do with his bill is to change that clause from $500 to $1,000. So it would have the effect on Senator Chaudhry's bill in that the computer, if the computer was worth, you know, that much money, if the computer was worth more money, it would be the same penalty, essentially. So it doesn't directly affect Senator Chaudhry's bill, but it is related.
So Senator Chaudhry, there might be an impact. Are you hearing anything that concerns, that makes you concerned?
Yeah. Chair?
Senator Neville.
I think it probably, Senator Chaudhry's bill a little broader. I don't think it does any harm to his bill. It now says he added a subdivision 5. Let's see, to the situation where if you've got particular kinds of property than 500, so now it's going to be not more than 1,000. You could have a more valuable computer, and it would fall under your provisions.
Senator Neville, while you're both there, let's do your bill.
Right. Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Senate File 780.
This is a relatively simple bill. It affects the theft and criminal damage to property statutes by making an inflationary adjustment to the threshold dollar values. So if it's under current law, anything up to $250 is a misdemeanor, $250 to $500 is a gross misdemeanor, and over $500, is a felony. This doubles all those values. I'll give you the history. Actually, Mr. Turner provided me with a memo in 2003. I had a bill like this, and then last year I had a bill like this as well. And it's my understanding that we have had these thresholds basically since 1987, with one small exception. We, in 1999, I guess we raised the gross misdemeanor threshold from 200 to 250. But other than that, it's been this amount since 1987. So if you apply inflation to these values, you get about the values that are in the bill. I guess there's a few witnesses who'd like to comment on the bill as well.
Senator Neville and to our witnesses, the bill is pretty self-explanatory, right? I mean, you know, you're raising the amount. So can you hang on and we'll see. We'll just take questions from the members. Is that all right? I don't mean to be disrespectful. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Neville, you claimed that this was an inflationary adjustment, but all of the numbers are conveniently doubled. And I'm just wondering, have we had a 100% increase in inflation since 1987?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I think so. Maybe my witnesses can tell me exactly what it is, but when I had the bill last year, it was just about inflation at that point.
Madam Chair and
Senator Limmer.
Senator Neville, I'm leading up to a question. if you're recognizing an inflationary adjustment on the thresholds, would you consider a like inflationary adjustment to the fines that are mentioned in this particular area of statute?
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, that would be problematic because we have other statutes that kind of set the definition felony and gross misdemeanor based upon maximum. Well, just wait. That only deals with the probationary time and the jail time. I guess you could affect the fines as well. I hadn't thought about that, Senator Limmer.
You were a defense attorney, weren't you?
Was.
Would those fines go into the public safety budget division?
Members, I think that this bill had already passed the committees once, and it was supposed to be in the omnibus bill to pass off the floor. But apparently there were some issues last year. So that's why it's now back. Senator Betzel.
Just a question. Normally on many criminal law bills like the one we just passed for Senator Chaudhry, the effective date says it's effective August 1st, 2007, applies to crimes committed on or after that date. Do we need similar language in this if we're changing the threshold? Because these are current crimes, but we're kind of changing it, so I don't know whether that the effective date language has to go in here or not.
Senator Betzold, I think it's always a good idea, and especially if they're cross-referencing each other, I guess we should make them effective at the same time so we know. At least we want Senator Neville's, we want the language to be consistent. Okay. So, Senator Neville, would you object to the effective date of August 1, 2007? Or is that the effective date if you are silent, well, Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, it's silent, but when we have laws affecting criminal law, we state that it applies to crimes committed on or after that date, just so that's clear.
I see.
Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair, yes, that's the common effective date for criminal issues, and also we like to say and applies to crimes committed on or after, just for clarification.
Senator Neville, would you object to that?
I think it should have the clarifying language. It applies to crimes committed on or after the effective date.
All right.
Also move.
Senator Betzel move that we give council the latitude to put the effective date in the language to be effective August 1, 2007, comma, and applies to crimes committed on and after that date. Any discussions on that amendment? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion passed. Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, just another, and this is a more procedural question. I'm anticipating Senator Neville's bill would not have to go to a budget division. It could go to the floor, where Senator Chaudhry's probably would have to go like that. But we don't know ultimately, if both these bills were to pass, which one would be signed into law first and which one would be signed into law second. And I'm just wondering, and council may have to, would it matter, you know, if we're changing it? Or should we somehow incorporate, reconsider Senator Chaudhry's bill and then put some of this new language into Senator Chaudhry's bill so that they are consistent, and then Senator Neville's bill on his own. I'm just wondering, does it matter if one bill is signed into law before the other?
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, I was just conferring with Ms. Pontius, trying to remind ourselves what the exact rule on that is. I believe that I don't think it would matter because I don't think the two amendments would be inconsistent. I think they would just be merged by the revisor's office. But that's certainly something we'll check on just to confirm that, because it is an important issue.
Madam Chair, I believe that if there's an inconsistency between the two bills, I think that the assumption is the second one should govern over the first, because the legislature had a chance to consider both issues. But sometimes we do pass things that are inconsistent, and sometimes it matters.
Well, Senator Betzel, we are really smart in this committee to consider both of them on the same night.
Yeah, right.
Senator Neville, I think that this has to go to finance, your bill. I believe Senator Foley would like to see it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
I guess if that's what the committee would like to do. I don't think it has a cost. I had a fiscal note done last year that shows it has a potential to save beds at the prison level. If anything, there's a savings.
Cool. Well, that's a financial impact. No.
Except we're not going to take money away from corrections because of that. So I don't think it has an adverse financial impact on the state. And I think that the fiscal note said that, in fact, I have it here. It also suggested that that any impact on the local jail services would be expected to have only a very modest impact on local facilities. So I don't think it really does. But if you want to get an updated bed impact statement to see how much savings we have, I suspect that the savings from this is more than the cost of Senator Chaudhry's.
Senator Neville, another very respected member of our committee and chair of a separate committee would like to see it. Let's send it to him.
All right, we'll send it to him.
Thank you. Senator Neville, is there any further discussion on the bill? Senator Higgins.
I have a couple questions, Madam Chair. Is there a 20-year felony, or is a 10-year felony as high as it goes? And I apologize. I just plain don't know this stuff.
Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, for theft, there's a 20-year felony if it's above $35,000, and that's, if you look on line 1.8 to 1.11, that's the existing theft statute right there.
Okay. And then is it also common in the criminal statutes that all of page 1 and almost all of page 2 is all one sentence?
Senator Higgins, from all the nodding, I think the answer is yes.
It must be because they're all laughing at me. Okay.
Madam Chair?
Senator Neville.
I have to clarify one thing. In addition to the general theft and criminal damage property, Section 2 deals with dishonored checks. So there is a third aspect to the bill, but the intent is that to deal with all these financial thresholds.
Yes, I see that. Any further questions for the witnesses? Are there any members of the public who are here to testify either for or against Senate File 780? See none. Senator Neville, what is your wish? Oh, Senator Limmer.
Thank you. Senator Neville, have you heard from any law enforcement or prosecuting attorneys that may be concerned about this adjustment?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I have not from them. I received one call from a banker. That's it. Last year, my memory is so terrible. The county attorneys did weigh in. My recollection is that the county attorneys did not object.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
Supporting it this year, too.
All right. Thank you. So the county attorneys support this bill.
Anyone else who wants to testify on this bill? Senator Neville, what is your wish?
Well, Madam Chair, I'd like to move then that this committee recommend that Senate File 780 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee.
On that motion, is there any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All of the opposed say nay. Mr. Plunkett and Mr. Sakura, thank you. Thank you. You'll be back. Senator Ortman.
All the amendments here. I need to go back.
The engrossed version of your bill. Does all the members have the Senator Ortman's Senate File 294? Senator Ortman, you can either walk us through it or I can have Mr. Backus walk us through the engrossed version of the bill just so that he can just point out what we did to your bill. Is that all right? Would you like to do it, or should I have Mr. Backus do it?
I appreciate that, Madam Chair, and perhaps counsel could do that on my behalf. I also have a handout for the committee, and if it's available to pass this out, I think it would be helpful. Madam Chair, I will tell you that there are a couple of amendments I think that the members are hoping we would consider, and I have one as well.
All right. Well, we'll have Mr. Backus. Can you walk us through just what we did to the bill to get it to this engrossed version?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, yeah, so the changes made last week, the first change, I mean, no particular order, maybe in bill order, had to do with adding Section 1 to the bill. That language, I believe, was in Senator Moore's bill on sealing of arrest records, and it provides that employment applications that seek information regarding prior arrests or convictions must state that the request does not apply to sealed or expunged criminal records. The next provision had to do... under current law, and this, let's see here, this would be, and I might be skipping out of order, I'm sorry, but on page 4, lines 26 to 27, under current law, expunged records may be opened for purposes of criminal investigations, prosecutions, or sentencing upon an ex parte order that was changed to apply to just a, without a court order. The language on lines 32 to 34 on page 4 were also added. That basically is a return to current law regarding DHS background checks. And the language that was in Senator Ortman's original bill regarding other types of statutorily required background checks was deleted. The next, another provision was the provision on business screening services that was deleted from the bill. And then finally, the language in subdivision 11 on pages 5 to 6 was changed. Originally, under Senator Ortman's bill, an expungement decision was totally discretionary with the judge. Senator Neville and Senator Ortman amended that, and the new language begins on line 5.31, and it provides that a court may grant an expungement if it determines by a preponderance of the evidence that the benefits of the petitioner outweighs the disadvantages to the public and public safety after considering the factors that are listed in paragraph A above it. And then paragraph C provides that if the proceedings have been resolved in the petitioner's favor, that the expungement shall be granted unless the agency or jurisdiction whose records would be affected shows by clear and convincing evidence that the interest of the public and public safety outweighs the disadvantages to the petitioner of not sealing the records. And those were the changes. Oh, I'm sorry, there's one more, and this is very minor, but on page 6, lines 12 and 13, we just added a cross-reference to that new section 1.
All right. Senator Ortman, does that sound like what we did to your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the wise counsel of the committee to allow everyone another opportunity to look at this as we've amended it. It's given everyone, I think, that's been watching this bill another opportunity to look at it and share their wisdom with us as well. And I know there's at least one other amendment to be offered by a member tonight, but I have one that I'd like to offer if this is an appropriate time, Madam Chair.
It is, Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would offer the A8 amendment. Madam Chair, can I briefly describe this amendment?
Hang on a second, Senator Ortman. We'll let the page get the amendments out. All right, Senator Ortman, on the A8 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The changes in this amendment were provided to me by former Speaker Carruthers and Mr. Kingery from the County Attorney's Office, who came very graciously to my office this afternoon to talk with me about some changes that they were suggesting, and I thought they were very good changes. I would ask the committee to adopt this amendment. The first one is to page 2, line 7, and what that does is just make sure that we are not having currently the bill is drafted so that you cannot apply for an expungement if you are on probation or if you are currently charged with a crime, and they asked me to clarify that that includes petty misdemeanors as well. If there currently charges pending, we do not want folks applying for an expungement. That is the first change in this amendment, Madam Chair. Second one is at page 4, line 15. What that does, members, is it explains that when we have someone who's going to apply for a job, we want to make sure that if they've done that, the criminal background checks can be made. And specifically, we want to make sure that in further criminal justice proceedings, all of those proceedings and the courts would be able to use the previously expunged record for purposes of enhancing a crime, for sentencing on the second crime, and things like that. I think that that was included previously, but this is an important clarification. I think that it improves the bill and for purposes of clarity. And then the last change in the amendment is page 4, line 30. And members, what that change would do is just make sure that if a criminal justice agency is doing a background check on a prospective employee, all expunged records would be available, not just convictions, but also arrests. If we're talking about criminal justice agencies, you want a prospective officer reviewed, to have been reviewed for arrests as well as convictions, any kind of contact with the criminal justice agency. So that made perfect sense to me. And, Madam Chair, I know that with respect to the third one that we talked about, the changes at page 4, lines 15, I know that there's another amendment from one of the members of this committee that would fit in well, and we may want to discuss that at this point. I know Senator Olson has an amendment that might fit in very well here, and I would entertain I think this would be a good time for that conversation to amend this amendment, if necessary, before this one goes on.
Senator Orman, am I to understand that Senator Olson has an amendment to your amendment?
She can offer it separately, but I think it would make sense if because it fits right into page 4, line 15, and maybe offered as substitute or additional language to this amendment for clarity's sake. I mean, she can offer it or not, but that would be my recommendation to the committee.
Senator Olson, what is your wish?
Yes, I would prefer to do that, Madam Chair, because I don't believe that Senator Ortman objects to my amendment, and because the way that the paragraphs are going to line up, for example, my subparagraph B is going to say it's her subparagraph B, so I'm going to need to alter that or it isn't going to work with the subparagraphs correctly.
Senator Ortman, why don't we adopt your amendment, and then we'll have your language in the bill, and then we'll have counsel then work with Senator Olson's amendment so that we're not talking about multiple paragraphs.
Very well.
I think that's the best way to do it.
Senator Very well, Olson. Madam Chair. I would move the A8 amendment at this time.
Members, any questions for Senator Ortman on the A8 amendment? Senator Lumber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, if I could refer you to line 3, insert a crime or petty misdemeanor. When I think of petty misdemeanors, I'm not necessarily thinking that it's necessarily the same type of criminal action as a whole host of things. But this refers to in the event that one is applying for an expungement and they would be charged with a petty misdemeanor. Tell me, give me some examples of what a petty misdemeanor might be. I know you're not prepared for this, but I just think that this may be such a low bar to trip stopping an expungement. I need to understand what a petty misdemeanor is.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, if I could defer to Senate counsel for a description of that, but the amendment, again, was brought to me by the county attorneys. I do think that if there are criminal charges pending that have not been resolved, that's probably not the right time to ask for an expungement because now you've just had an altercation or a contact with law enforcement. We don't know whether it was justified or not because it's a charge. But I'll let Senate counsel explain the scope of petty misdemeanors.
Senator Backus.
Madam Chair, members, a petty misdemeanor is it's defined as a petty offense which is prohibited by statute, which does not constitute a crime, and for which a sentence of not more than $300 may be imposed. I mean, the key element is you can't be incarcerated. It's just a $300 fine. And I'm blanking out right now of there are hosts of petty misdemeanors throughout statute, and, of course, I can't think of a single one right now. There are millions of them.
Jaywalking.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lumber.
Would a common traffic violation be a petty misdemeanor? Or jaywalking, spitting where you're not supposed to?
Senator Lumber.
Raising your voice in a certain environment? I don't know. I just think that might just be petty misdemeanor just doesn't seem to me to be something that should stop a expungement. If you're already qualified or if you're being considered by a judge to consider whether or not you have this life of crime following you after your sentence has been commuted and whether or not there's a time factor involved from that last point forward, I just think that petty misdemeanor is, a little petty.
Speaker Carruthers. Senator Lumber, I would think that from a policy standpoint, if someone's about to get an expungement, if they've got a traffic ticket or something outstanding, that maybe it's a good thing for them to come clean.
But, Madam Chair, a lot of us get traffic tickets, but we aren't considered a criminal either.
That's true.
Madam Chair, if
Mr.
I could,
Speaker Carruthers.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Senator Limmer, the concern on the petty misdemeanors, it's not because a petty misdemeanor is a huge deal, okay? I mean, it could be a speeding ticket. You know, they're not heavy-duty offenses. But we have a policy in this state. There's a statute that says judges should not have the power unilaterally to continue a ticket for dismissal, okay? Or, and then there's Supreme Court rules that say a judge, except in very limited circumstances, is not allowed to do a stay of adjudication. And all these are, those are big terms for where a case is put aside, okay? And then if the person goes through a certain period at the end of that time, then it and they don't have any new offenses, it doesn't exist, okay? Prosecutors believe that that is a prosecutorial discretion. And frankly, we don't want judges doing it. Case in point, Dakota County, you know, we had a couple of judges who, you know, just kind of in their chambers, you remember that, continued some cases for dismissal. We just, prosecutors feel, we're very liberal about giving continuances for dismissal. We just don't want judges doing it on the objection of prosecutors. And so we're concerned that if you allow expungement, essentially it's a way to get around that prohibition on a judge just on his or her own continuing a ticket for dismissal. Okay, so that's why we ask that that be inserted.
And Madam Chair, if
Senator
I could
Ormond.
Just add to that, one of the reasons why I agreed to it is the thinking that if someone's coming forward, they should resolve those charges. They may plead guilty, they may pay the fine, they should resolve the charges so that they aren't, and then the court can consider that when they decide whether or not to issue the expungement or not. I'm just saying resolve it. It should, outstanding criminal charges that haven't been resolved should make, if that's the case, then that person should not be before the court if they have not yet resolved their issues.
Any further questions? Senator Ormond on the A8 amendment.
I'm sure.
Senator Limmer.
I'd like to move an amendment on this amendment. I would like to strike the word petty on line 3.
Senator Limmer. Senator Ormond.
Madam Chair, if I could ask Senator Limmer to just amend his amendment so it makes sense, he should just delete lines 1.3 and 1.4 and leave the language in the bill the way it is because a misdemeanor is already included in the definition of a criminal
right.
in the law.
I'll move, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer moves to strike line 1.3 and 1.4 on the A8 amendment. Senator Ortman, what do you think about that?
Well, I've set it out for the committee, I believe, Madam Chair, in the best way I can. And so now at this point, I would take the guidance of the committee.
Very good. Any discussions on Senator Limmer's amendment to the amendment?
Thank you, Chair.
Senator Betzel.
I think it makes a certain amount of sense. Frankly, I think if somebody is dumb enough to seek an expungement when they have even any kind of outstanding charges or, you know, things that are resolved, I think the judge is going to notice that. So I don't think we need to say that. I think that, you know, we can probably go along with this amendment without doing too much harm with the bill.
Any further discussions on the amendment to the amendment? All those in favor on Senator Limmer's amendment to the A8 amendment, say aye.
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 All the opposed say nay.
No.
Nay.
Motion passes. On the A8 amendment, as amended, is there anybody in the audience who wants to speak on just the A8 amendment? Just the A8 amendment. All right. On the A8 amendment as amended, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposing say nay. The motion passes. Now, Senator Olson wants to offer the A5 amendment. Senate Counsel will help us walk through. Does everybody have the A5 amendment? All right. Mr. Backus will walk us through the A5 amendment now that we've adopted the A8 amendment. Mr. Backus.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, excuse me. Could I have a copy of the amendment?
All right. Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair and members, the A5 is drawn to the bill, the underlying bill. I think the easiest way to look at it, though, is to draft it to the A8 amendment. And if you look at the A5 amendment, we would want to delete line 1.3. We would not need that. And then on the A8, on line 1.5, you would delete paragraph B and insert paragraphs B and C. And then on the A8 amendment continued, after line 1.11, you would insert line 1.5 of the A5 amendment as paragraph C. And then you would insert the remainder of that amendment, lines 1.6 to 1.9. And that last part is the part about changing the background study language, which I don't know if you've discussed that yet.
Senator Olson, after all of that, why don't you tell us what your amendment does?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My reason for offering the amendment and my concern was that when there is a statutorily required background check, I wanted to make it clear that for those purposes that an expunged record would be as available as it is to law enforcement for other legitimate law enforcement purposes, and also with respect to the subdivision that relates to whether a person has to divulge the fact that they've been convicted of a crime by answering yes when they're asked that question, that they would also have to answer yes to that question when it related to a statutorily required background check, as opposed to some employment situations where the employer may want that information, but it isn't statutorily required. In those cases, the person would be able to continue to answer no. And I did discuss this amendment with Senator Ortman, and she is, would it be fair to say in agreement with the amendment or that you're not opposed to the amendment?
Well, Madam
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. I understand what you're trying to accomplish, I believe. But when I look at the amendment, Senator Olson and Madam Chair, I'm not sure that it does what you've just described. I'm not sure that it changes anyone's responsibility, a job applicant, from disclosing. But it does allow the statutory background check to be conducted and all records be unsealed for purposes of that statutory background check, is my understanding. But perhaps Senate counsel can advise on the full impact of Senator Olson's amendment.
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and members, yes. The changes on line 1.6 to 1.9 do amend the situations in how an expunged record is going to be opened for purposes of a background check. Instead of saying it may be opened for the DHS ones unless the court order is directed at the Commissioner of Human Services, it'll say the expunged record shall be opened for purposes of a statutorily required background check. So it's meant to accomplish that. And then it's meant to accomplish the subdivision 7, which is the effect of the order, how the person is to respond if he's ever been convicted of a crime or whether he's going to be held guilty of perjury. It would provide that entire paragraph does not apply to a statutory required background check.
And, Madam Chair, that is my intent.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. Could I just get clarification from the Senate counsel about the scope of those statutorily required background checks?
Mr. Backus, does this mean that under the amendment, the A5 amendment, statutorily required background check situations, any expunged records will now be made available? Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, that's my belief, yes.
Madam Chair, my question was, I was looking for just a very brief overview of the types of things we're requiring. I think it includes daycare licensing, and I'm wondering if you could just generally advise us about what types of background checks we're talking about so we can make this decision.
Madam Chair and members, I don't, off the top of my head, there would be those DHS background checks. There's the Carrie Koskinen background check for apartment managers. I think I think the study we heard from last week said there were 40-something statutorily required background checks. And the way I would interpret this is it would have to be a required one. There are a couple of statutes which authorize background checks that this wouldn't apply to. But I think it's 40-some background checks.
Madam Chair, and I think that would, for example, if a person were applying for a foster care license or a daycare license or those types of situations where someone is in a special relationship with perhaps a vulnerable person, I'm concerned that if we are presently requiring by statute a background check be done for very specific reasons, and we've pass laws that indicate there's a special need for a background check in those circumstances, that we're not tying the hands of whomever may need that information.
Any other discussions on Senator Olson's amendment, A5 amendment? Senator Neville.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know what those other 39 are or how many of them are human services connected. The bill as it stands already made the exception for the human service related jobs, which presumably would deal with most of the vulnerable population. And I guess I'm just raising the question, isn't this the type of thing that a judge would be able to consider? And so, I mean, if we adopt this amendment, I can envision, based on how things work around here, is that every year somebody will come in and ask for one or two more statutorily required checks, and you know there'll be an egregious case, and it'll be creep, and we'll go kind of be losing the effectiveness of what we're trying to accomplish.
Madam Chair,
Senator Olson.
On the other hand, Senator Neville, without even knowing what we might be prohibiting in terms of disallowing that kind of information, I'd be very concerned that we are precluding valuable information where it is really needed in a pretty sweeping way. And I guess I don't feel comfortable making that kind of a sweeping judgment for when we've already said we have good reasons. Oh, I guess the other thing I was going to say is that I lost it again. So, I guess
Madam Chair,
Senator Orman.
One thing I've learned tonight is that Senator Metzen is going to ask for this bill in the Jobs Committee. And that may be an appropriate place to talk about those statutorily required background checks and whether we not want to include them in this or exclude them and have more discussion about what we're currently requiring.
Senator Orman, I'm looking at on page 4, line point 32 to line point 34, and I'm going to ask Ms. Backus this question. Is Ms. Backus, if we adopted Senator Olson's amendment, and that second line, 4.33, it says, unless the court order for expungement is directed specifically to the Commissioner of Human Services. So even if we were to put on Senator Olson's amendment, somebody could get an expungement order to direct the Commissioner of Human Services to expunge that. No, we wouldn't be able to do that.
Madam Chair, that would be the purpose of my order. And now I remember now what I was going to say in response to what you said, Senator Neville. When a judge is looking at these expungements, that judge can't possibly know at that time what future purposes this person might want to, you know, engage in as far as all the different things that we have these statutorily required requirements in place right now. So the judge isn't necessarily going to be contemplating the appropriateness of the expungement with respect to one of those specific things because once the record's been expunged, then that person's free to go forward with in any direction he or she might choose. So I guess that would be my concern.
All right. Senator Scheid.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just thinking of the one thing that Senator Ortman handed out about, and that happens to be about a Michigan person, and I don't know, I assume it's from the Detroit Free Press from sometime just a few days ago. It seems to me that these are the kinds of things that others were asking before that would be able to be expunged. And with Senator Olson's amendment, you wouldn't have a choice, I think. So, I mean, I'm inclined to think that, well, I put it this way, I'm sympathetic to the person in this situation. And I think there should be some relationship between what it is they want to do and what the crime was, and also the circumstances of the crime. And I guess I think that a judge can, you know, one person can make that decision, but we're saying, no, I'm sorry, forget it, because we're not going to give you another chance. There are certain things you're just never going to be able to do, and I don't like doing that.
Madam Chair, though,
Senator Olson.
We're not saying that a person is going to be prohibited just because this information is brought forward. That'll be up to the individual agency or the individual circumstance to make that decision. But without this amendment, my understanding is there wouldn't even – this information would not be available to them. And again, I guess I just reiterate that the judge isn't going to know at the time they're making that decision what the future circumstances might be as far as what that person's intending to do.
On the A5 amendment, is there anybody in the audience who want to speak just to the A5 amendment?
Two people.
Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Neumeister. On Thursday, there was similar language like this. There was an amendment done by a committee member, and you voted to take out that language and only leave 245C, where access to the expungement of records. There are approximately between 38 to 40, give or take a number or two, of background checks, both that involve the private sector and the public sector. So if you allow where to an expunged record is allowed to go for those situations, you have to ask yourself then, why is the expungement worth anything anymore? Particularly with historically, as someone has mentioned, every year, even this year, there are one or two background check bills that I've seen. There may be more. So you continue on. If you adopt this amendment after studying expungement language across the country, this will be the most expansive allowance of expunged records for background checks. Generally, they do allow for human services, which you've already adopted, and that has been a general policy. Number two, in the last comment, is I think if you go this route in the long run, then it will affect folks' rehabilitation or whatever. I lost my train of thought on the point, but I think you get my point. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Speaker Carruthers, on the A5 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Philip Carruthers from the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. I think Senator Olson is onto something important, because the statutorily mandated background checks, they go way beyond, I shouldn't say way beyond, but there are a number of them that go beyond human services. For example, my recollection is that the Board of Teaching has to do a background check on teachers. So under the, if you did not adopt the Olson Amendment, the Board of Teaching would not have access to expunged offenses. And, you know, it could be something small, it could be something very serious. And as she points out, at the time that the expungement is granted, the judge may not know that the person is going to be apply to become a teacher. And actually, the reason I say this is the least you should do is because there are all sorts of agencies then that would still not have access, even if this were adopted. For example, the accounting board, the lawyers board, the medical board, all of these that have a lot of responsibility and that are not statutorily mandated, but that do background checks nonetheless. Thank you.
It's hugged off.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Melinda Hugdahl, Legal Services Advocacy Project in St. Paul. I just wanted to raise a couple of points about the language in the gross version, the fourth clause about the background check. As the language reads right now, which is a carryover from current law, the information is available to the Department of Human Services when they do the check, unless the court order at the time the expungement order is granted precludes DHS from access to those records. So unless if the person later on, they have their original expungement order that didn't include that provision, and later they asked to become a foster care worker, a child care provider, DHS would see those records under the language of the statute because the original order wasn't specifically directed to DHS, unless they just did that as a blanket. Everyone did it as a blanket practice, I suppose. The other piece is that if you look at 245C.08, subdivision 1A, or 1B, it contains parallel language within the DHS background check statute. So if you would take it out here and leave it in Chapter 245C, I think you may be creating a conflict between the two provisions, where one is saying it must be looked at, and 245C says it's looked at unless the court directs otherwise.
Don't worry, Ms. Hogdahl. We'll be consistent. If we do something to the one area, we'll take care of it in the other.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Ortman.
One final comment on this issue. At 4.32, we say that an expunged record of a conviction may be opened for purposes of a background check. What I'm concerned about are the arrests that might stop someone, some charges that were not fulfilled or there wasn't even a conviction that might stop someone from becoming a nurse's assistant or a laundry person in a nursing home, and that's what we don't want to do when we pass this bill.
All right. I think we've had sufficient discussion on the A5 amendment. Senator Olson moves the A5 amendment as amended by Senate Counsel. Any further discussions? All those in favor of the A5 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
No. No.
The amendment does not pass.
Madam Chair, I have an amendment.
Senator Neville.
I have an A7 amendment that could be circulated.
Can you make sure Senator Ortman gets one?
Yep.
Senator Neville, on the A7 amendment.
Madam Chair, I view this amendment as being one to clarify. We had this discussion last time that what we're really trying to do with this bill is force the courts to use the statutory procedure if we're going to expunge the executive branch records. So this amendment just makes it explicit that the court has no order to expunge executive records except as provided in this chapter. It's consistent with this Schultz decision, and I heard at least some information today that some judges, despite Schultz, are still trying to order that, and so we want to make it explicit.
Senator Ortman, your reaction to the A7 amendment?
Well, Madam Chair, we have been trying to set out parameters within which our courts will issue expungements and also some expectation on the part of the public about what the factors are that they'll consider. And these inherent authority expungements fly in the face of that. We don't know what they'll do under the circumstances and what kinds of orders that might be out there. And so this was definitely the conflict between the Senator Betzolt version and the Senator Ortman version of this bill. So I'm going to defer to the wise counsel of the committee. I do have my own opinion on that, and I will vote, but I'm going to let Senator Neville make his case. Case may be.
Is there any further discussion on the A7 amendment?
That was very coy.
Is there anybody in the audience who wants to testify on the A7 amendment? Senator Neville moves the A7 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Senator Limmer.
I have an A9 amendment, Madam Chair.
The A9 amendment.
It needs to be passed out. This particular amendment is in regards to how we're parsing words on page 4, line 12. And I'll wait a bit until it's fully passed out. This concern was brought to us by Professor Joe Olson from Hamlin. And, I'd like it to ask him to come up and explain his amendment and explain his concern of how the bill was drafted originally and his concern about drafting.
Welcome back to the committee. Please restate your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Senator Limmer. My name is Joseph Olson. I'm a professor of law at Hamlin University. I'm also a registered lobbyist for the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. This actually is a truly technical amendment. The process of seeking relief of disability can happen before, coincident with, or after an expungement proceeding. And so by taking the word thereafter out and by simply recognizing that the time frame can be from 5 years earlier to at the same time to 10 years later, it clarifies the bill, and it doesn't have an unintended consequence of ordering these two proceedings, which are done by separate agencies at separate times.
Senator Orman, on the A9 amendment.
Madam Chair, this is Senator Limmer's amendment, and I would hope that he would address the amendment before I say whether I oppose it or not.
Senator Limmer, would you like to address the amendment?
Senator Ortman, if you look at your language on page 4, line 12, the word thereafter, I think, is problematic. Thereafter means a point in time forward. It doesn't mean a point in time prior, and there could have been an expungement prior to that point in time. I think Professor Olson is trying to recognize an expanded timeline that your bill does not quite recognize.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Orman.
Chair, I support Senator Limmer's technical amendment to the bill.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, perhaps counsel can refresh us. What's the relief of disability under U.S. Code Title 18, Section 925 that is being addressed here? I don't remember what that does.
Mr. Backus.
Yep. Madam Chair and members, I don't really know. This language is current law, and it was reproduced in Senator Ortman's bill. And I see Ms. Professor Olson, I'm sure, has the information.
Professor Olson?
Madam Chairman, Senator Betzel, that's the federal language that allows persons who are disqualified from owning firearms under federal law to have the disqualification removed. It's a federal process which is undertaken by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
Any further questions to Professor Olson on the A9 amendment? Very good. Any further discussion, Senator Limmer? Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I can see thereafter probably doesn't add anything, but any expungement would only work forward. I don't know how you would go backwards. I don't know. I don't know what the words "or has received" adds it. If you want to take the word thereafter out, I suspect it still works. I don't. Nothing works backward in time in law. We always, nothing's ex post facto. It's always moving ahead. So does the words "or has received" add anything? I think it's more confusing. I think take the word thereafter out, and maybe that's what's got to get done here.
Ms. Pontius, and then Senator Shy. Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, I think the reference is to when the relief of disability occurs, which is, I think, where the confusion came from, not when the expungement occurs.
Right.
So you may have the relief of disability, then you get the record expunged.
Right.
And that relief of disability would still apply.
Well, then, Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel,
couldn't we just say, you know, who has received a relief of disability?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I think that would work, too.
Okay.
Or you could just delete thereafter.
Yeah.
Who receives.
Yeah.
So I think it would include all tenses.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Could I ask Senator Limmer to be willing to amend his amendment to just make it, just delete the word thereafter? I think that solves the issue, and I would support his amendment.
Senator Scheid.
Ms. Pontius, Madam Chair, Ms. Pontius took the words out of my mouth. That's what I was going to say.
Okay. Senator Limmer amends his amendment to delete thereafter. Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair and members, I believe the amendment would be line 1.3, delete receives, and then delete everything after that. So the amendment would be page 4, line 12, delete thereafter.
Senator Limmer, you'll just incorporate that into your A9 amendment.
Another re-election legislation.
Well, let's vote on that. On Senator Limmer's amendment to the A9 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. All right. Now, on the A9 amendment, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the A9 amendment? Seeing none. All those in favor of the A9 amendment as amended. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
No.
The amendment passes. Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 294 be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee.
On that amendment, is there on that motion, is there any further discussions? Seeing none. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I don't want to belabor this point. We've already voted on it. I just want Senator Ortman to understand my hesitancy with supporting her bill, and that's now that we have ruled on that issue, I'm concerned that a person is going to be saying yes when they're asked if they have ever been convicted of a crime, and in fact, they're going to be asked that question and they're going to be allowed to say no. And that is going to make the job more difficult for law enforcement and for human services and for other authorized statutory background checks. And I know that our systems are not infallible. I've been personally involved in at least a couple where significant crimes were missed with background studies, and not flagging that by allowing the person to say no, and then hoping that they're going to catch it is just making their job more difficult. And so while I support the idea of expungement generally and what we're trying to do here, I think that's a real significant concern I have.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I could. Senator Olson, I think it's a very valid concern. And I think I hope that you will work with me because I share your concern. I think what we should do is look through the list of statutorily required background checks and then work through a couple of hypotheticals together and see what happens with some of these actions. And maybe we can resolve that when we go forward into the Senate Business and Jobs Committee, which is a proper place to maybe deal with these statutory background checks for job applicants. And so I hope that you'll work with me on that issue. I commit to working with you on that through the course of the next several days if this bill passes.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, and it might be that I would want Ms. Hugdahl or somebody to respond to a question I have. I know that Senator Ortman's bill sets out factors to be considered by the court. I have the impression that you don't go cold into your request for expungement, that you have to show that you have you turned your life around or taken steps to change the course of your life or to atone for your mistakes. Am I correct in that? Or maybe Senator Ortman can.
Senator Ortman.
The focus of the factors to be considered is rehabilitation. I mean, that's the whole gist. We're looking at the time that's occurred. Have you gone through employment? Have you shown steps to rehabilitate yourself? There are all kinds of things in here where we're looking for evidence of rehabilitation so that we believe that you are justified in applying for a job and maybe getting past some of the obstacles to getting that job. And so that was the whole purpose of the factors, was that consideration of whether or not you've rehabilitated yourself and can be trusted.
Speaker Carruthers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Phil Carruthers from the County Attorney's Office. To answer Senator Scheid's question, all the bill does is say that's to be considered. a person need not have been rehabilitated at all. A person could come in with five felonies on their record. As long as they're not going through probation currently, as long as they don't have a current charge against them, they can not only seek expungement, they can be granted expungement. They may have not paid their restitution. They may not have paid their fine. They may not be good citizens at all. In our county, I looked at the statistics, 80 to 85% of so-called inherent discretion expungements, those are ones presumably where there's a conviction, okay, are being granted. 80 to 85% are being granted. Now, personally, I'm a little doubtful that 80 to 85% of those people have, you know, fully rehabilitated themselves. You know, hopefully some have, hopefully, you know, a good percentage have, but I think it's being granted, you know, pretty liberally. I think people are showing this is going to affect me in a job, and they're getting it. And you know, sometimes that's a bad thing that it's affecting them in a job, but sometimes they have convictions where it should affect their ability to get a job. You know, you don't want somebody with crimes against children getting a job as a daycare worker, for example. So that's how I would answer that.
All right. Any further discussions on Senate File 294? Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, if I could respond. I appreciate what the speaker says. If the judges are applying these expungements on a discretionary basis 80 to 85% of the time granting them, they aren't even considering the factors we want them to consider when they do that. And if you look at the factors as set out in Subdivision 11, we say that the court shall consider them. They must consider them. If they haven't, then they've abused their discretion. That's the whole point. We're trying to create a process that we can all trust, and we want to be able to trust the court in applying these factors and then determining whether someone has been rehabilitated or not and allowing them that fresh start. And that's the whole purpose here.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I might, and then if you go down further on page 5, 5.35 and 36, it does say if the proceedings had been resolved in a petitioner's favor, the expungement shall be granted unless, and that unless language is pretty important, I think, it's established by clear and convincing evidence that the interest of the public outweighs the disadvantages. I think that's an appropriate, you know, which I don't know what the word is I'm looking for. It's too late for me. But anyway, I think that's an appropriate step and a test you'd have to meet. So I understand going in the other direction, it's just a preponderance of the evidence, but I'm not including that. There, at least the court would have to look at this if the agency or jurisdiction, or I don't know, who is it, the agency or jurisdiction whose records would be affected would challenge it. So I feel pretty secure about that.
Senator Neville.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Senator Ortman, on page 5, line 14, in light of the discussion we've just had, is it good enough to say just that the court shall consider, or do you think it might be worthwhile to say and make written findings concerning? I mean, I don't know if that's in family law. I think you have to do that. There's a number of factors, and you have to make findings concerning that. Would that be something you think necessary? Do you think if we tell courts they have to consider it, it's going to be in writing anyway?
Well, and make findings what?
And make written findings. I mean, I'll bet most of the time that expungement orders are granted, the prosecutors don't appeal these things anyway. But if they did want to appeal one, they'd have a basis to challenge a finding of fact if it were arbitrary. Well, how do you react to that?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Neville, I appreciate the question. I think we've got the courts balancing interests, and when you do that, it might be better to have them saying how they've come with their, you know, how they've come to their conclusions. This is what I've balanced, one thing against the other. I'm never against a court issuing written findings, but our trial courts don't typically issue written findings in every case that comes before them. And so I would, if you want to offer that amendment, I would support the amendment because I do think that written findings are good. I also think that if you do that, there may be a fiscal note on this, and, you know, the courts may come forward and say we've just created a huge burden for them. I I'm kind of stuck in the middle there, but I would not oppose
Senator
the requirement of written findings.
Well, Madam
do you
Chair,
want to make the motion?
Yeah, I'll make the motion.
Senator Neville moves on line 5.14 after consider, insert.
Shall consider and issue written findings concerning. Does that work, Senate Counsel? Okay.
And then Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, I was going to say it would make sense to put that at the end under B and C, where the court is balancing the interests, and then say setting forth in written findings.
Consent of counsel. My mind's tired. Consent of counsel, help me. You're fresher.
Madam Ms. Chair, Pontius. Senator Neville, I think maybe on page 5, line 33. Considering, I suppose you could say after considering and making written findings regarding the factors listed in paragraph A.
Yeah, I think we should just do it on the top where I initially suggested.
All right. Senator Neville moves that on line 5.14. I have to consider, insert, and issue
written findings
concerning. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Ortman, as you began to study this, what do courts do now? Do they make reference to a stay of time after perhaps a sentence has been commuted in order to show that the person has, after that sentence has been finished, perhaps after the parole time, an additional period of time that would reveal that the person has, in fact, changed their life, they have not shown any sign of criminal behavior before an expungement is made? Is that considered when a judge would consider expungement now?
Senator Ortman and members, I am ready to move this bill, so keep that in mind. Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, the current practice is not that at the time of the original sentencing the court is going to say, and I think that in 5 years you may be rehabilitated. I don't think that the courts make those findings at the time of the initial sentencing. And in the inherent authority expungements, there is no waiting period that I'm aware of. In fact, there is no waiting period in terms of the statutory guidelines right now. I would not be supportive of a waiting period that just sets a period of years. I think that the courts are capable of determining whether someone has rehabilitated themselves, whether it's 3 years or 8 years out or 20 years out, and I would hate to put some kind of an arbitrary number on it and then disallow the court's discretion on that issue.
All right. Senator Ortman, just for your information, I did receive, and I'll make it available to you, a note from Ms. Marshall, as well as not necessarily a separate note, but she did check with the Department of Public Safety, and they have concerns that this would have financial implications. So I think that once you've gone through Senator Metzen's committee, it might need to be referred also to the Committee on Finance. Senator Higgins, do you have any final thoughts?
Which division? Does this go to Senator Foley's division? I mean after that. Because it's the courts, right? I'm just worried about trying to...
We'll figure that out.
Public safety, too.
We'll figure that out.
Public safety, too?
Perhaps.
Yeah. All right. Senator Ortman moves that Senate File 294, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Business, Industry, and Jobs. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
The motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Betzel. Senate File 644.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm losing my audience. Oh, well.
Aren't you lucky?
Madam Chair, members, Senate File 644 deals with a number of issues that are currently on the books. It amends the identity theft statute, although this could actually pop up elsewhere, you know, in the statutes. The issue that we're looking at is the fact that it's easy to make. We have laws in the books dealing with threats, intimidation, bullying, identity theft, and we have laws that can deal with them. However, in this age of the internet, cyberspace, there are ways that you can threaten, intimidate, bully, and so forth, defame, harass, in brand new ways, and it's difficult for prosecutors to try to identify the specific law that is being used when it's a combination of the of using websites, MySpace, and so forth in doing so. We've got some witnesses who can testify as to this. Obviously, people can use the internet and go on somebody's MySpace and make a threat to them. It'd be a pretty foolish and dumb person to actually identify, you know, who they are in doing so when you can use somebody else's identity. And there have been instances when websites have been created, people have been threatened by the use of this. And so, although throughout the statutes we have various laws that can address it, this particular bill kind of tries to pull all these elements together into one. Basically, if somebody is using the internet, using websites, concealing their own identity for the purpose of harassing, for bullying, for threatening people, this kind of hones in on ways to do it. So I'll turn it over to witnesses, and they can give testimony as to some real-life examples and some of the reasons why they believe this is necessary. So,
Senator Betzel, do you want to put your amendment on?
Oh, yes, and I don't. There's a technical amendment, and I don't even have a copy of it. Someone that's counsel spotted, so.
Senator Betzel, I'll just have Mr. Backus explain it to us.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, the amendment does two things. To begin with, on page 2, line 13, the cross-reference to the definition of harass and the harassment restraining law is to current law, which is a two-prong definition. This just clarifies it's to the first prong, which defines harassment as engaging in intentional conduct which the actor knows or has reason to know would cause the victim under the circumstances to feel frightened, threatened, oppressed, persecuted, or intimidated, and not to the second part, which is that actually causes that reaction. And then it also amends the penalty provision under the bill. Currently, the bill provides for a 10-year felony, and this would make it a gross misdemeanor offense.
And, Madam Chair, the last part is kind of important because a lot of these crimes are being committed by juveniles, and I don't think we want to go to the felony route, you know, with what the things we're talking about. So I'll move the A1 amendment as an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape that I desire to proceed with.
On the A1 amendment as an author's amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. The amendment is incorporated into the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now I'll turn it over to my witnesses.
Madam Chair, I'm David Voigt, an Assistant Attorney General. The Attorney General is in support of this legislation because in today's internet world, there is such tremendous potential to harass and defame other people and to reach a wide, wide audience with simply a click of the mouse. And some of the examples have been devastating to the victims. We hear anecdotes all the time about people using social networking websites, for example, like MySpace.com, to impersonate another and to do that to either intimidate or humiliate that person. Under current law, there's a harassment statute which doesn't really seem to fit that conduct, and there's a defamation statute which traditionally has been used and applies to other forms of communication. And what this bill does is it It takes elements of both of those statutes and it combines them to the identity theft statute, which is really what victims of this type of conduct feel, is that they've had their identities stolen.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Voigt.
Hi.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Karen Snorek. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm here tonight representing my son. My son, Matthew Snorek, is age 14. On September 11, 2006, he was interviewed by the Owatonna Police Department at his high school in Owatonna. At that time, the police department asked our son if he had ever done, if an individual had ever done anything physical to him or said anything inappropriate to him. The police department showed our son a picture of a 19-year-old. Our son easily identified this individual. This individual was involved in the Owatonna Youth Hockey Association, was a member of our church, was an employee at the local theater, and was our daughter's high school prom date. Our son informed us that afternoon that we needed to contact the Owatonna Police Department to arrange a meeting with them. On September 13th, we were notified by the police department that this 19-year-old had stolen our son's identity. He had our son's name, non-pornographic pictures of him, his grandparents' address, which was less than a mile away from our home, and he was on the internet soliciting sex with minors. This 19-year-old was using our son's identity to engage in graphic sexual discussions with other individuals through the internet to allegedly solicit sex with other teenage boys and possibly distributing pornographic material of children. During this meeting, we were shown pictures of our son that was received by a detective in New Hampshire that was working on this case. In addition, we were also shown the picture of the 19-year-old who had portrayed himself to be our son. We easily identified the 19-year-old. We were asked by the Owatonna Police Department to keep this information confidential. On February 3rd, 2007, we learned that charges and a court appearance was made by this 19-year-old. How we found out was also disturbing. As we found out through another hockey parent, this hockey parent happened to be reading the Duluth newspaper when they read the article. The description that was in the article, even though no names were identified, this parent easily could identify that it was our son's identity that was stolen. Since that time, since October 11th, 2006, when this individual was searched with a search warrant and his laptop was taken, and he knew the reason that his laptop had been taken was to look by the FBI for pornographic material, this 19-year-old continued to come to Owatonna and to ref our son's hockey games. He was on the ice with our son during these games. Our primary concern here is the safety of our son. We have no idea who this 19-year-old communicated with besides the New Hampshire police detective, and we have no idea who he might have communicated with, who might have passed this information along to subsequently other individuals. Our son's name, photograph, and hometown address is listed on the internet worldwide, and to be honest, it terrifies us. We don't know who's going to show up, possibly looking for our son to try to engage in the sexual activities that was talked about on the internet that he would be willing to do. Every time a car drives slowly by our house and I happen to be looking out the window, I wait until that car leaves to know that no one's coming to our house. We try to do everything we can to have our son protective. We make sure that he's always in the hands of an adult. All times. He's 14 years old. He wants to spread his wings, and yet at the same time, his identity was stolen and used in such a terrible way that I don't know when I'll feel safe again for my child. So I encourage you to pass this identity theft bill.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing with us your personal story. Senator Betzel, is there anyone else to testify?
I don't have anybody else. I don't know if anybody else is here to testify.
All right. Questions for Senator Betzel. Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, if I could ask the witness, what was this 19-year-old charged with, if anything?
He was charged. He's currently being charged with possession and disseminating child pornography. Identity theft is not an item that he's being charged with.
Okay.
Mr. Voigt, if this bill was current law, would this 19-year-old be able to be charged with the intent to harass or the intent to defame?
Madam Chair, under the current bill, if someone were to impersonate another with the intent to either harass or defame, they could be prosecuted. And in this situation, as I understand it, you have an intentional act by the other individual using the victim's identity to solicit sex with underage boys. The definition of defamatory matter is anything which exposes a person or a group, class, or association to hatred, contempt, ridicule, degradation, or disgrace in society, etc. So, yes, I think that fact pattern would fit within the definition of defamation. It's not your classic fact pattern of impersonating another one on the internet with false information with intent to humiliate, but it's yet another twist of someone else's identity being used not for financial motives but for different motives.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I'm going through the scenarios in my mind, and you know, I'll bet the 19-year-old who stole your son's identity wasn't thinking about your son at all. He was using his identity, his intent in using your son's identity was not to get caught. And he probably never gave a thought to harassing or defaming your son. He did. That was a fact, that was a result. But his intent, and I just wonder if that would be considered a defense. If he could come up and testify, you know, it's true I used somebody's name, but I wasn't even thinking about that. I was just thinking of being able to get pornography on the internet without using my name. So I'm sympathetic to the issue. I'm wondering if this is the language that gets it.
Mr. Voigt.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, it was an intentional act, as I understand it, by the perpetrator, which had the effect and falls within the definition of under subdivision 1 of defamation. Now, what you're identifying may well be a proof problem, and it may well be a jury question whether the intent has been met, but there.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
My suggestion is that you should say a person who intentionally poses. It's the posing that has to be done intentionally, and not with the intent to harass, but with the effect to harass or defame. Wouldn't that be getting more at what your scenario is?
Mr. Voigt?
I agree that would better encompass this particular scenario, yes.
Well, that Madam Chair, that fixes
Senator
this
Neville.
Scenario, but are you trying to get more scenarios than this? I mean, I guess I want to know what the intent of the author and you are.
Senator Betzel.
Well, certainly, Madam Chair, Senator Neville, anybody who intentionally poses as another, you don't accidentally pose, right? And I think that this can hit other scenarios. As I indicated, I think if somebody's going to use the internet, websites, MySpace.com, and so forth, and use their own identity to try to harass somebody else, I mean, they're being dumb. certainly people are going to pose. And there's other scenarios. As an example, there's a high school principal that that was recently in the news, and other people here may have the specific facts on it, where the students put something out there that was intended to harass, to intimidate, you know, but they put stuff on the internet, and of course they didn't identify who they were. They just put the stuff out there anonymously, and it was embarrassing to the individual. And at some point, some of the definitions on the books don't quite establish, okay, which crime is it? Harassment, criminal defamation, and so forth. But I think that right now we're trying to pierce the veil here to hold those responsible who are doing this anonymously. I think that if they identify themselves, we may have them, you know, with the current laws on the books. You know, there are laws against harassment, against bullying, against defamation. But I think it's these people that are trying to use the veil of the internet and cyberspace to try to cloak their things. It's causing a bit of problems. You know, once we find them, I think this gives one more tool in the box to try to hold them responsible for their actions. And so, I don't think you pose, unintentionally or so forth. But if you want to, but the word intentionally, I don't know if it really changes what we're trying to do here.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I agree that I don't know that you need the word intentionally, because your definition of pose already talks about falsely. So yeah, that probably is good enough. But what if somebody, let's take the same scenario here, and the 19-year-old just picked the name Joe Smith, and there is a Joe Smith.
At least one.
Maybe he just goes down the phone book and picks somebody out randomly, and his intent is, you know, not to hurt anybody in particular, but to just get an alias. Would that be covered under this?
Oh.
Senator Betzel.
I don't know that.
If he doesn't even know the person?
You say he expressed authorization.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Voigt.
Senator, I don't think that situation would be covered under this bill, because if you're picking a name at random, you're not posing as a specific person. You are simply putting out a name.
Well, okay, so Madam Chair, let's say you just go to the phone book and pick a name randomly. So you know it's a real person, but you just, and you don't have his authorization, but you don't know the person, so you really don't have any particular intent toward that person. You're just providing a cover. Well, that, maybe I'm getting too fine-tuning here, but.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
I mean, with email addresses and people who buy things on eBay and so forth, people are making up names all the time, because, frankly, I think people are protective of their personal privacy, and if you use somebody else's name, as long as you're not harming anybody else, I don't know that does it matter, you know, if you have a made-up name that happens to be somebody else's name. I think it's only when you cross that line and cause problems for somebody else because you're buying things in their name, because you're trying to intimidate somebody else, because you are using somebody else's name and trying to hide your own. No blood, no foul, but if there is, if there's some harm here, I think there should be some consequences.
Senator Betzel, I'm in just thinking about this bill, I keep coming back to really, it might be an issue of fact for the court to determine who has acquired the harm, right? Who has the cause of action? If A uses B's identity to harass C and to defame C, C is the one who is harassed and defamed, and C can go after A under current rules. I mean, C can go after A under current statute. But what you're doing here is to say that if A, and using B's identity, though, to harass and to defame C, uses some kind of information about B that can come back in that result in some way that is harassing or defaming to B, then B would also have a cause of action?
B and C should be able to go after A, yes.
go after A.
Yeah.
And I guess the connection between, I mean, because that's not a direct causation of the harassment. It's sort of a backwards looking. It isn't necessarily that you did it intending to cause me harm, but it resulted in harm of harassment and defamation. And I guess if that's the case, then I'm not quite sure that the language of the bill fits that. And I'm not saying that it, from a public policy perspective, it isn't important to recognize that, because certainly that's what we want to capture, but I'm not quite sure that the language here does that.
Madam Chair, one way to get at that would be to take out the intent language at all and prohibit posing as another and causing the harassment or defamation of that person or another person. And then you don't have that proof problem that Senator Neville brought up.
And I think then that leads to what I was saying, is that it resulted in the harm, whether there was intent or not. Senator Olson.
We've got some language right.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, the person who testified here today about her situation is, just looking at the crime as it already exists today, I guess it says on subdivision 2, a person who transfers, possesses, or uses another identity, as this person did to your son, with the intent to commit an unlawful act or to commit a crime, it appears to me that that person, whether they chose to charge him that way or not, was that situation looks to me as though it was already covered under existing law, and that the additional law that's being proposed by Senator Betzel basically is an extension to include when there's an intent to harass or defame another person that may not have otherwise been a crime under existing law. And so, but I do think it's important that you do include the intent to harass or defame, because otherwise it becomes pretty wide open if they just intentionally used another name and then someone determines in their mind that that was harassment or defamation. I don't know. I guess I just think that's a little bit broader. But I'm just wondering if that what we had wouldn't have already been something that would be addressed to what happened to your son, ma'am, and whether this isn't more intended just to get at when someone's deliberately stalking or harassing or intentionally trying to hurt someone else.
Mr. Backus, do you have something for us? Mr. Backus, you can ask Mr. Backstrom the question.
Madam Chair, members, I think there's the witnesses sent some language up here, and it would say let me read the whole paragraph. It would be paragraph B, a person who poses without the express authorization of that person or persons and causes the harassment or defamation of that person or another person is guilty of, and it goes on. And I might suggest to say and harasses or defames, as opposed to saying causes the. I don't know if that's any better or worse. But then I was wondering if how that impacts the amended definition of harass that the A1 amendment put on, because if you're going more towards the current crime of harassment or defamation, would you want to not go back and pick up that full definition of harassment in that case if you're going away from the intent to harass or defame?
Madam Chair, we've got a number of issues, and I appreciate the witnesses coming up. They've got a long ride to Owatonna, so I think what maybe might be in our interest to just kind of lay it over and let us work on this a little bit to come back with some language that is going to fit.
And Senator Betzel, let me apologize. I had gone with Senator Chaudhry's two bills because I was led to believe that his witnesses were the ones from Owatonna. And I really do apologize. That was my intent in going first with that bill. So I'm sorry that we hung you up here so late. Your bill would have been first because I wanted you out of here, and I do apologize for that. All right, well, I agree. I think this is something that we do want to help you do something with, but Mr. Voigt and Senator Betzel, perhaps you can look at some language and bring it back to us. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering how this would affect emails, you know, where somebody grabs your email address and sends off all manner of garbage, and or whether this would affect that at all. You might get it spam. That might be kind of a fun thing. But while you're thinking about the rewriting for your bill, that's just one piece I had, was kind of like email and grabbing that identity.
That would be good. Thank you, Senator Betzel.
Thank you.
Have a safe trip back home to Owatonna.
Thank you.
All right. The committee stands adjourned.
You're really woken up when you said...